Greg Walsher with us, Natural Resource Group, of course, the professor Stephen Hines. And today we're talking about water, coming up, water issues. And really, this is probably one of the single most important issues when we're talking about energy development in the world of fracking and oil and gas. I talked to the North Dakota Health Department, their water division, a couple of weeks ago regarding the Davis refinery and the aquifer they're going to be pulling from. And his quote was, "This is the single most important issue in energy development today." And I, you know, last week we had Greg Walsher on and we were talking about this and he brought up the water issue. So we had to bring him back to talk about this because in the Bakken, just that alone, they came out with some speculation a few weeks ago that they might need 20 times the water that they originally thought. And last week, of course, we brought up the fact that water isn't as abundant as, say, natural gas is in the western side of the United States. So, Greg, set the table for us a little bit about when we're talking about water in the western side of the United States, it's really not as abundant as it is on the east, is it?
No, in fact, water in the west is the most valuable and the most scarce of all the natural resources. You know, the late, great Chairman Wayne Aspinall, the Westerner who chaired the House Interior Committee for 25 years during the most important development of the West, was often quoted saying, in the West, when you touch water, you touch everything. And it is literally true. And there is a difference in the West than the rest of the country, as you well know. And it makes the politics of the issue so complicated because half of the country doesn't have to deal with it. But just to sort of lay a groundwork for why this is so important in the West, people have to realize how scarce the resource is. Think about the fact that 90% of the water on the Earth is too salty to be available for human use. 5% of the Earth's water is locked in ice at any given moment, and another 3% in clouds. That leaves barely 2%. Of all of the water on Earth available for use by all the plants and animals and human beings in the world. And of that teeny, minuscule amount, 2% of the Earth's water, 80% of it is in the major river systems, from the Mississippi to the Nile to the St. Lawrence, the Volga, the Rhine, the Amazon, and so on. That means that of the percentage of the Earth's water that is found in all the arid states west of the Mississippi is not even statistically measurable. And then when you get into the West, then you have a series of issues that even compound it further than the fact that there isn't hardly any water. In most of the Western states, in fact, 80% of all of the annual water comes in the form of snow, which means in about a 4 or 5 month period, you get all of the water that you're going to get for the rest of the year. In a lot of states, including my home state of Colorado, there are 14 other states with 100 million people who depend on water that originates in Colorado. That means 10 other states have legal claims to the water that prevents people who live in that state even from using it all. And, of course, there isn't enough combined storage capacity in any of the basins of the West to store all the water that is needed. And finally, as if all of that wasn't complicated enough for people, in almost every Western state, the vast majority of the water falls on a different part of the state than where most of the people live. In Colorado, almost 80% of the people live on the Front Range, and 80% of the water falls west of the Continental Divide. That's true also in Wyoming, in Montana, in Idaho, in New Mexico. There's all kinds of places around the West where the resource is needed by a population in a different part of the state than where the resource is. So in a state like Colorado or North Dakota or any other Western state, there just flat simply isn't enough water to go around. And so you have one choice and one choice only, and that is you have to store the water during the wet periods so that you can use it in the dry periods, or you cannot live there.
When we talk about energy development, and you've seen this time and time again, you know, the industry versus community, back and forth, that sort of thing, and without getting into the raw water versus, you know, civic water, industrial water, the different types, What have you seen? What has your experience been on the balancing act with local communities that are essentially oil and gas towns that they need that water to bathe and drink, but they also need that water to create jobs and have energy efficiency? What has your history taught you in terms of the balancing of that natural resource?
It actually has taught me over a long period of involvement in this issue that the old original constitutional system of prior appropriation is about the only way that you can resolve this issue, because there isn't enough water. I mean, at some point, the people have to decide: do we want A, use of the water, or B, use of the water? And if you leave that to the vote of the public, there just won't be any development of the kind that you're talking about. So you can't just say, let's set aside 20% of the state's water for energy, because what if the state develops differently than that and it winds up, you know, having huge population centers that need water for municipal purpose, and so suddenly there's no political support for agriculture, for example, which is the largest use of the water in the West. Well, barely 2% of the people in agriculture feed all the rest of us, but if all the rest of us have to decide, do we want water in our homes and showers, or do we want food, that would be a difficult choice. But it's never put to us that way. It's always put to us in this difficult political battleground that we find ourselves in on energy issues, where people are saying, don't produce the energy because there isn't enough water, or don't engage in logging or grazing or oil and gas or any, you know, pick whatever use of the land you want. There's a group out there that's opposed to it, and they will inevitably use water as their excuse to do it. So you've got to rely on a very complex and delicate and ancient system of water law, or there won't be any water.
Greg, I'm going to really defer to you, because while I followed through the EPA, the waters of the United States, or what is called the Clean Water Rule, but one of my questions is to you, so how do you get the water from the west of Colorado to the east of Colorado, where the population is?
Well, first you fight about it for 100 years. the famous Mark Twain quote, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. That's kind of the truth of it in the West, but there are trans-basin diversions all over Colorado, and a substantial portion, literally half of the entire water supply of the Colorado River, is diverted to the Front Range through a system of pumping stations and reservoirs and tunnels that go under the Continental Divide and bring the water to Denver and Fort Collins and Colorado Springs and Pueblo and so on. So the technology, of course, has been around for 100 years to do that. That part of it isn't complicated. It's the politics of it that are always so complicated.
Well, and I think I told you, Greg, I was born in Lamar, Colorado. That's where my mother is from.
Yes, you mentioned that.
And so that's the east, you know, that's more Kansas than it is Colorado, really. So does the eastern edge of Colorado then get it from eastern, farther east, or how do they get water?
Oh, certainly. One of the biggest water diversion projects in the history of the state was the Frying Pan, Arkansas project, which built Rudi Reservoir up above Aspen and takes water out of the Frying Pan River and pumps it under the divide and puts it in the Arkansas River Basin. So, yes, all along the Arkansas River from Leadville all the way to the Kansas line, people benefit from transbasin diversion, as well as from storage of their own water supplies, too, in major reservoirs like Pueblo Reservoir and others that are up and down the river.
I was just going to ask about when you layer in the politics of the BLM, you know, you're talking about some state and some other stuff and the EPA, and I'm just thinking about some of these western states. You know, I mean, I think we discussed before, Nevada, what is that, 95-97% is owned by the federal government, whereas, you know, North Dakota is exactly the opposite. North Dakota, like 95% of the state is private mineral rights. That's one of the big reasons why we have a Bakken boom here, whereas Montana and some of the outlying areas don't. It's just the way that's made up. How does that does the BLM play into this as well? I mean, I can imagine that just probably adds a new layer of just red tape like we've never seen.
Well, federal control of water is contrary to the body, to the largest body of federal law. And it is the biggest threat that there is to water use in the West. You put your finger right on it when you talk about the difference in the ownership of mineral rights and energy. States like North Dakota and Texas, even though they are in the West, are primarily private land. And so you have access to all sorts of energy that other states are not developing. And it isn't because there isn't oil and gas under Montana and Wyoming and Colorado. It's because the federal government owns all that land. So just think about what it means if the federal government suddenly controlled all the water as well. You wouldn't be using it in North Dakota. They wouldn't be using it in Texas. So when the federal government threatened to take over control of all the waters with the Waters of the U.S. rule, it was an enormous threat to the entire country, but especially to the West.
You know, Vicki Steiner, she's from North Dakota State Legislature. She was traveling around quite a bit, doing some consulting and, you know, advising to some of these different states, being from North Dakota. She lives out in the Bakken oil field, and she described Alaska really well to me. And, you know, this is a very dumbed-down version, but she said, you know, when the state owns the mineral rights like they do in Alaska, you're only dealing with like two companies, BP and Shell. So that's because it takes forever to decide anything. Whereas versus in North Dakota, in Texas, like you mentioned, it's up to, you know, it's a 45-minute coffee and maybe some homemade biscuits and we can come up with a deal right there at the table. That opened my eyes a little bit when she talked about how the meat grinder of bureaucracy up in Alaska, to where they essentially, the government said, we only just want to deal with a couple different organizations and that's it. Is did you following my very dumbed down version at all?
Yeah, it's not dumbed down at all. It's the federal government studies everything to death before they can make a decision on anything. We call that analysis paralysis. Now, that just flat stops them from being able to make decisions on a wide range of things because of the need for environmental impact statements, environmental assessments, even a finding of no significant impact, which is supposed to be a two-page document that can be issued right away when they determine there isn't any big environmental issue. Even that takes 2 years to do, and is likely to get appealed and have lawsuits filed, and the whole thing winds up in court, and the next thing you know, some judge has ordered a full environmental impact statement, and that's a 10-year process, and it's just the process goes on and on and on and on, and it's all about process, not about the substance of the issue. So, the question is about how much energy we need and how much we want to produce locally versus import from other countries. We ought to be having that argument, not arguing in court over whether or not every I was dotted correctly. I don't mean that we should ignore environmental issues. I don't mean that at all. But there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. Anybody who thinks that private individuals who own land ignore the environment and don't care about their own backyard, that's a concept that's just plain offensive to people that own the property and live there.
Well, and Greg, you mentioned in our last discussion about how habitat has become one of the great roadblocks from any economic development, and then you layer on water issues out west. It's very clear to me that you can obstruct anything for two decades without even breaking into a sweat.
Yeah, it's gotten to the point where any idiot can stop anything in this country, and some of these activist groups were not just talking about any idiots. It is incredible how simple it has become to stop things by objecting to them, because you have a governmental system from top to bottom that sort of begins with an instinct of being opposed to everything everybody wants to do anyway. So any excuse they can get to stop things, they will.
You know, you brought up a root issue, in my opinion, which I've been doing some due diligence for a story we're going to be working on, which is essentially leadership reinvented. And we did discuss this a little bit last discussion, but what I'm hearing is right now it just seems like over the last, I don't know if you want to call it a decade or what, leadership has just been afraid of so many different things. And so they're so reactionary that it just has worse consequences. And so to me, I've just been questioning leadership, because they do. It's like they won't take a look at something and have common sense and have a little bit of logic put into something, they get reactionary or they get their heartstrings pulled. And I want to give you the example of water, because here in the North Dakota, we had the Dakota Access Pipeline. And in the beginning, when it first started, there was a legitimate argument about water. And then when they started peeling back the layers, it turned into a politicized, wrapped around, we're just going to use that as our way. And so it became a false argument once they found out how deep the pipes were being built and a number of different things, to where it wasn't even near the water. But you have to have that emotional heartstring in order to advance the narrative further. What my question goes back to the leadership. What can we do, what can leaders do in order to stop that emotional heartstringing to say, no, you got to come with something a little bit more than that, pal. You know, we're adults here. Are you following me at all on this, Greg?
Yeah, I think the first thing leaders need to do is decide they want to be leaders, and that means to openly talk about the issue, talk to the public about what the details are and where the other side is coming from, and be honest about it. What we've got instead of that is a group of leaders across all the different industries, but since we're talking about water in particular, you have a series of water leaders and water districts all over the West, all of whom know that we do not have enough storage capacity to store all the water that we're going to need for the additional economic growth and prosperity that is coming. And yet, it's been 30 years since water districts have proposed major water storage projects. In my state of Colorado, 35 years since the last one was proposed, and it took 25 years to build it, and the others have all decided that it's just simply too complicated, too hard, too much opposition, too difficult politically, and so they nibble around the edges all the time, and frankly have come up with some very creative ways to do water exchanges and to do water conservation, all of which should be part of the mix anyway, and they've gotten quite good at that, but at the same time, they've sort of forgotten the importance of water storage, which is just no longer part of the discussion because it's so complicated, so hard to get done. Nobody wants to even propose things anymore.
You know, I was going to bring up something. I was down in Scottsdale about a year and a half ago. It was something put on by the Public Utility magazine, and I met Bob Murray for the second time, which is a kind of a controversial name, a chief executive of Murray Oil, a leading spokesman, if that's the right word, for coal. And one of the problems, and I like Bob, away from the microphone, but he is facing such opposition. Again, this goes not so much water, but it really goes back to your question, Jason, that he was so inflammatory that, you know, I bet his mother didn't like him when he was speaking in front of people because he took such a hard line, but he was really the only person out there speaking. So in some ways I thought to myself, well, of course he has to talk this way because nobody else has the nerve to do it.
Yeah, I've been accused of that myself sometimes because I like to get up in front of, I make a lot of speeches and I get up in front of groups and tell the truth as I see it. And if that's somewhat controversial, so be it. If it starts a big debate about these issues, and I think we're light years ahead of where we were earlier when no one was even talking about it. So I don't mind the controversy. I think people need to be talking about the issues more openly and frankly with a more honest agenda and not pretending that there's some environmental issue that's not really what we want to talk about. If the opposition to energy is based on some kind of a world view that we should stop using energy and lower our standard of living and start living in smaller and less comfortable homes and stop driving cars and stop using modern conveniences and so on, I think that's a legitimate point of view, so bring it on. Let's debate about that. But to sort of claim that the issue is really about polar bears or something that it's not really about is just disingenuous. And so I think we all just need to be talking about the issues much more openly and honestly.
You know, I've been working on my website, and on my homepage, I have a photograph taken. I was at a Wall Street Journal conference. They had an annual conference out in Santa Barbara. Sorry, I don't mean to be dropping names. But it was called Economics. So I have my little Wall Street Journal thingamabob holding my name tag, and I'm speaking in front of a group of people, and a lady friend of mine wrote back after she saw my photograph. She said, don't you have another photograph? And I sort of wrote back, and I said, well, why? She said, because you look too fierce. And, Greg, you and I both know this. If you're a lone voice, if you aren't fierce, you're going to get run over by a bunch of tanks.
Yeah, that's certainly right. Well, we need to, just in this, furthering this thought about talking about these issues more directly, one of the things that I think we quit doing a couple of generations back is we stopped talking to kids, particularly in schools, about how water works in the West. When I was in elementary school, I hate to admit how long ago it was, but a tour of the local water plant was an annual field trip for all the kids in second grade. And we heard from all these people who explained to us how it works. When I was running the State Department of Natural Resources, I used to go into schools periodically and talk to the kids about natural resource issues. And it was incredible how little they knew about it, not because they're less intelligent than we were, but it's just not part of the curriculum anymore. I used to ask kids, for example, I was in the third grade room once, and I asked them about the cycle of water and if they knew where the water in their faucet came from. And of course, they all knew about this cycle where it rains and then it evaporates and becomes clouds and then rains again. They all knew that. But I asked them, how does it get from the rain into the faucet? One kid in the entire classroom raised his hand and talked about the fact that there were pipes buried in the street. He'd seen when they dig up the street, he knew that there were pipes out there. And that brings the water into your house, which is great. But I asked him then, how does it get from the river into the pipe? And there was an absolute 100% disconnect. Not one kid in the school knew the answer to that question. Nobody has ever talked to them about the need to build water diversion structures in the river. You don't get water in the pipes if you don't have a dam and a reservoir and a pumping system. And nobody's talked about that at all. So I just think we need to talk about it more. If kids don't know that that's why we have dams and reservoirs, then someday they're going to be voters involved in the political discussion about dams and whether to tear them down or remove them or allow them or whatever. They're going to have a very different view of it if no one's ever explained to them that you don't get water in your house any other way.
Yeah, it's interesting when their view of a dam is going to be more or less whether they do water sports or not is the main reason why they're going to hang on to a dam if they don't understand the reason for it. Let me ask
you. More likely they're going to take the Bruce Babbitt view, though, that the dam is nothing but a threat to the salmon and therefore needs to be torn down.
I never thought of that. Yeah, you're right. Let me ask you about the future of water. You know, I mean, to me, I see what is being done in the terms of energy development is positive in terms of relaxing some federal regulations, opening up some overseas foreign markets. I've mentioned many times in the past, you know, I think Rex Tillerson was put in place on purpose, and a lot of it had to do with global energy. And I see the future of energy being bright. And I'm not just saying that because I do an energy show. I'm doing an energy show because I think the future is bright, to be perfectly honest. I just happen to believe in the philosophy behind energy development. So it's a nice win-win for me. Where do you see the future of water? I mean, you know, in the Bakken here, we, like I mentioned earlier in the opening statement, there's speculation, and it's good speculation, that they might need 20 times the amount of water. You mentioned, you know, realistically about 2% of the Earth's fresh water is available for public and industrial use, that sort of thing. Well, not industrial because you can use raw, but where do you see the future of water going? Are we going to be in a lot more courtroom battles when it comes to water? Is there going to be some abundance in terms of allowing energy development to happen? Talk to me about your experience and speculate where you think the future is going.
Well, I'm an eternal optimist. I think the future is very bright, as you said, with respect to energy. That is all about the development of better and better technology all the time. The Earth is a big, gigantic ball of fiery energy. It's just a question of whether we have the technology to get to it in any particular spot. And the future, therefore, is very bright because the technology keeps getting better and better. There isn't any limit to the extent that technology can take us in a free society where the human mind is free to develop and think and create. I sort of feel the same way about water, although the amount of water statistically available that's in North Dakota is about as close to zero as you can get. But also, that's a question of technology too. And we have the technology to turn oceans into drinking water. There's some places in the world where they do that. Not so much in the United States because it's a little bit pricey, but nothing compared to the price of what we spend on arguing about water and suing each other over it. So I think the future is quite bright. The only thing that gets in the way of it, both with respect to energy and water, is an overzealous and overactive regulatory system. And public pressure, people caving in to people who are opposed to the use of water and opposed to the use of energy. If we don't let government get in the way, the future is incredibly bright.
Well, and there's this huge temptation, Greg, for government to try and take over. One more decision, and I was going over the language of the clean water rule or whatever. And here's the way Gina McCarthy, et cetera, talk about it. They talk about protecting U.S. regional water treasures. So here you have this glorifying of water, and the suggestion is somehow the locals or the state can take care of themselves.
Well, that's the real key to it, that last part of what you said. We all think water is a great treasure too, and in fact I can show you places around the West where it is so spectacularly beautiful, and I guarantee you Gina McCarthy's never been there. So I agree that it's one of our greatest treasures. The offensive part of that is this implication that if it's up to the local people, they'll destroy it in a heartbeat. And as I've said a couple of times before, there's nothing more offensive to the people who live there than that. Nobody cares more about my backyard than I do. The problem is, people don't take federalities on when they make comments like that. We ought to stand up and rear back and say, "How dare you?" I'm insulted by that, and so is my great grandfather rolling over in his grave about it. You can't just say, if I leave you to your own devices, you'll destroy your own backyard, and expect that you're not going to push back on that. And yet the federal government does it all the time, and they get away with it.
There's an issue out right now about moving the BLM out to where the federal government owns the most land. And, you know, so I keep wondering to myself, how could somebody from Washington possibly understand the complexity of issues that you face in Colorado or North Dakota?
Well, I'm in favor of the move. I've always been. This has been an ongoing argument for the entire 30 years I've been involved in politics. I have always believed that decisions are better made the closer to the local community they get, and because they're made by people who have to walk down Main Street the next day and face each other at the Kiwanis Club. So I'm all for that. I'm a little skeptical that it will ever happen because I've seen this movie numerous times before. But power to them. If they can get it done, they ought to get it done.
Well, this is probably one of those moments where it is possible versus just a little more chatter between people who will never get anything done.
Yeah.
Hey, where are we at?
It's not just more chatter. I know the people proposing it are very serious about it, so I don't mean to make light of the proposal. The reorganization that Secretary Zinke is talking about would go a long way towards doing that, and if they combine that with the plan being pushed by a number of Western congressmen and senators to actually acquire some of those agencies to move out west, we wind up with smarter administration and better control of the public lands, and frankly, it'd be better for the environment.
I was going to ask where the latest on the waters of the United States is. I followed it a little bit last year, a little closer. With the administration change now, has that been relaxed at all? Because I know up here there was issues about stock ponds and, you know, just even little, you know, we got a lot of potholes in certain areas which fill up full of water. And that was always used as an example of, you know, according to the waters of the United States, the federal government would have oversight over all of these, you know, potholes filled with water type of a thing. Kenmare is where they're located. So do you have the latest on that? Kind of, has that been relaxed at all, or is it the same old?
It is,
Go ahead.
No, it has been relaxed significantly in terms of the enforcement. I don't want to over-represent that the issue is done and over and settled, but there are several different ways to interpret what is a navigable waterway. That's the definition of waters of the United States in the Clean Water Act, is navigable waterways. The intention of Congress at the time, of course, was waterways that are used in interstate commerce by boats and ships and so on. And the interpretation over the years says, and the immediate tributaries to those major waterways. So over the years, what's a tributary has just gotten expanded and expanded and expanded. And under the Obama administration, publishing the Waters of the U.S. rule, which is a definition of how we're going to interpret that from now on, it interpreted to include all water in the United States that flows into any other water in the United States, essentially. So, and there are two different opinions written by Supreme Court justices about different interpretations. When the Trump administration came in, they reversed that ruling and went back to an interpretation that stems from an opinion written by a different Supreme Court justice. So, the interpretation now is still broader than I think it ought to be, but way different than under the Obama rule. And the courts had stayed the execution of the Waters of the U.S. rule, and the Trump administration officially withdrew it. So that withdrawal is in court, of course. The environmentalists sued over it right away, and it's unclear how that's all going to come out. But for the moment, it is not being enforced that way.
Well, and I think that right now that the administration, as of yesterday or today, has filed for a two-year extension on even coming back to the issue.
Part of the danger that they face all the time, of course, is because every single thing the administration does, they get sued for. And so the constant danger hanging over them on everything is some federal judge ordering them to reinstate the earlier rule. That is a danger on the Clean Power Plan. It's a danger on the Waters of the U.S. rule and on 500 other things.
And that was the thing. Go ahead, Steve.
No, I was just going to say, and that is the problem, given the complexity of these discussions now, water, energy. But, I made up a list I sent you, Jason, about what I cover, and it's just, one of the problems is that many people are an expert on one part of this jigsaw puzzle, but don't know anything about the rest of it. And there's almost nobody watching all of these things in like a juggler with 15 balls in the air. You have to have a 24-hour mind to keep track of it and make sure that nothing slips by.
You know, the one thing that getting back to the Waters of the U.S. thing that really concerned me when this was going on was, we had gotten calls from farmers and landmen and oil and gas. We had gotten calls from so many different industries on a local level, just talking about their fear. I'll just be honest. It wasn't hesitation. It wasn't confusion. It was just flat out fear. They were afraid that they were going to lose so much control over things that they had so little control of. And that, to me, is when my red flag started going, okay, this seems like this is extremism coming into the rule of law. And anytime you get extremism that's put into law, you know this as well as I do, that once something's law, it's tough to repeal, and it's tough to back, it's reverse away. It is tough. So to me, when that was put into play, the Waters of the United States, we're going through that right now. We're trying to reverse that. And like you kind of mentioned earlier, is that this isn't a done deal. We're just trying to back out of the driveway to get back into the old street right now. I looked at that Waters of the United States as a great example of how extremism took over government. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I do agree with that, and I hope people never lose sight of the vital importance and the enormity of that threat. If the federal government is truly going to be in control of all of the water, then I just guarantee you at some point in the not very distant future, there won't be any more use of the water in places like North Dakota. And unless you think that the vast majority of people in New York and Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., care about the people of North Dakota, which I don't think they do, that's what will happen, because it's very easy to portray to people who don't visit there or live there or care about it. It's easy to portray North Dakota as one of the last great places that needs to be saved desperately from you know, the corporate greed that will take it over. Otherwise, you could paint the picture yourself, and you know what the argument is that comes. So if you let the federal government be in charge of all the water, we're headed for a disaster.
And you can see how it's going to happen right now. I mean, you've seen it on a local level where the extremism has gone into place to where people are legislating rain barrels and how big your garden can be and a number of different things. And they cite water, and they always go back to water, which it's like children. You can't argue with it because water is life and everything else. And, you know, and so to me, that's what I start seeing. When I start seeing examples happen to where that authoritative control comes in over some simple day-to-day things like bathing. Oh, you know, you've seen the song and dance before. That's called the trickle up, the ripple up, to where it gets played out once the regulation gets templated in at a federal level. Well, now you've only got a couple people calling the shots instead of from community to community.
Well, and there's another problem with not just the waters of America, of U.S., the Clean Power Plan, but there's also a real vagueness to the writing of the rules, and there are a whole bunch of potholes in there, and it depends on how strident a regulator will be, whether they're enforced or not, or whether they're going to create a new rule out of the ambiguity of the old rule. Take a look at 111D, which is the excuse that the EPA used to write the Clean Power Plan. And what was the 111D? It was the difference in language between the House and the Senate. And from that, we got the Clean Power Plan and this notion that we could, that the federal government, of course, in its infinite wisdom, knew better than anybody else, and would decide what's best for us.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I don't want the federal government deciding what's best for me or my family. I don't want anybody other than me deciding that, actually. It's part of the concept of individual freedom that, as far as I'm concerned, is the foundation of this country. This is a country founded on the idea that ordinary people can govern themselves. We believe in self-government, and therefore we believe in limited government. And if we don't believe that anymore, then we've strayed a long ways from the founding principles of our country.
Boy, I couldn't agree more.
Cooperative federalism is what we've been using, certainly in the terms of electricity. And that is, the concept is a close balance between state and federal, but at the end of the day, the state holds superiority, like you have in North Dakota. Jason.
Well, I think at the end of the day, everybody's going to protect themselves and their family. And so if a government employee has a mortgage and a car loan and student loans and their kid's going to a private school and they want to make sure that their kid has the best soccer equipment and everything along those lines, they're going to do what they're told. They're going to do what they're told. That's how I've always looked at it, is that, you know, people are going to follow orders if they have debt and if they have things that they want to do and that sort of thing. And that's going to trump over what might be best for the community. Whereas a business owner has to really understand the idiosyncrasies and the culture of the community, because the community is the one that is allowing the business owner to be able to go to church and be able to go walk down Main Street and be able to have a livelihood, whereas the government employee just gets a check from the business owner, really, at the end of the day. That's how I kind of look at the ecosystem. And so for me personally, that's where a lot of my local control comes from, is that when you really base a community on capitalism, like oil and gas is centered around true capitalism, the type of capitalism that gives back to the community, boy, I don't think it gets in. To me, I don't know why we've strayed so far from that, because that's when we start to see the extremism set in. We had such a good system. Greg, how did we fall so far off track, I guess?
Somehow we've let people lose sight of the morality of capitalism. And I guess I'm not an economic historian enough to know exactly to be able to point to when this happened. But somewhere along the way, people have forgotten the gist of capitalism, which is I can only make money if I provide something that other people want and need and are willing to pay for. So I'm not just making money for my own greed, although I am doing that too, but I'm only doing that by providing a service other people need. So there is a great morality about a system where one person will say, I will make all of the fish hooks and you do all the fishing, and then we'll trade back and forth, and you know, between the two of us, we'll both have more prosperous lives for ourselves and our families. The great underlying sense of morality of that has been lost on lots of people, not everybody, but I think we need to talk more about it from a moral standpoint. Taking things away from people who earned it to give it to people who did not earn it is the exact converse of that. That is an immoral thing. Now, we've done some of that over the years to create a safety net for people that just sort of, you know, for whatever reason, were not created equal. But we've gone way beyond that now and just sort of undermined the entire system.
You know, I'd like to jump in for just a second here, because I had a conversation this morning. I drive my kid to school every morning, and the neighbor, he comes with, and, you know, he comes about 10, 15 minutes ahead of time. You know, we get to sit and chat while we warm the car up and a number of different things. And he had a science project due today. And I said, what's it on? He said, renewable energy. And I thought, oh, this ought to be good. Okay, fifth grader, science project, renewable energy. What's going on here? Okay, so it's on renewable energy. I'm just getting his kind of point of view from it. And, you know, he didn't really talk about the evils of oil and gas or anything like that, but he talked about how, you know, we need to focus on renewable energy and the benefits of renewable energy. And, he went into the 3 or 4 standard, you know, fifth grade, clean, renewable type of a non-dirty energy type thing. And all I thought was, I wonder if they're talking about how much subsidies money's going involved there. I wonder if they're talking about the social engineering and the PR and the marketing behind that. I wonder if they're talking about, you know, the more green we get with our computers, the more mining that needs to be done for lithium batteries. And, you know, and so I was thinking about all that different stuff. And there is a little bit of a social engineering tore away from the true benefits of oil and gas, in my opinion.
Well, I was going to say,
if you really want to mess with people a little bit, one of my favorite things to do with kids when they start talking about renewable energy is to tell them all energy is renewable. This whole concept that some of it isn't is just flat wrong. It's part of the arrogance of the modern world that we assume something is only renewable if we can see it in the next 10 minutes rather than in our lifetimes. But, you know, as long as plants and animals are still growing and dying and rotting into the ground, the earth is still making new coal, too. It just takes a bit longer. But all energy is renewable.
Jason, getting back to your question, I think it's a little bit like the image of a big pot of water that's slowly being raised to a boil, and there's a frog in there who could jump out of it, but it happens so slowly that by the time he figures out he's in trouble, it's too late. And I think that's really what happened to the federal government over the last 20 years. And I think ultimately, and this is my opinion, nobody else's, I think ultimately with the use of so many executive orders, that it really fits into what you were saying, that all people were doing what they were told to get paid, and all of a sudden one person was issuing executive orders, and everybody in the country had to dance to that tune.
I just have a real issue when people are using natural resources, religion, family, and that sort of thing to advance their personal agendas. And I think that's what's being done in energy. I think that, like I said, when I originally got into this thing, I was a journalist. I did the method journalism thing, went out to the oil and gas boom out in the Bakken oil fields. And originally I thought I'd probably be going in there writing a lot of investigative stories, you know, maybe against oil and gas, or that were not going to be favorable. After several months out there, I could not believe the opportunity that was going on in the oil and gas industry. Every time a guy goes to the well site, he has an opportunity to become an inventor overnight. I mean, that's incredible. The amount of redemption that was going on from a philosophical point of view in the oil and gas industry was remarkable. I mean, whether it's a 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, the guys being able to clear their head, the guys being coming out of bankruptcy because of the amount of money that we're making, the stories were endless. There was so much going on in the innovation world because drones were coming into play and big data and all these different things. For me personally, Greg, Steve, I got so wrapped up in just the absolute awesomeness that oil and gas was going through right now. I didn't even see a need for the political side of things.
Well, one of the reasons why I was drawn to you, Jason, is exactly that. I wrote to my son, who's 46, out in California, a liberal guy. He started talking about how disappointing Washington was, and I wrote back and I said, if you think there's a problem, political environmentalism, I think, Greg, you used this word before, political environmentalism is intellectually bankrupt. And America has a chance to have a second act and a third act. We can reinvent ourselves several times, and we are allowed to do it. We aren't stuck like England. Upstairs, downstairs, where we're downstairs for our entire life waiting on people.
I use the phrase intellectually bankrupt just in the sense that the environmental lobby today doesn't offer any solutions to any of these problems. None of this is easy. How to develop the resources it takes to build a prosperous economy in ways that our grandkids can be proud of us for. That's complicated, it's difficult, and it's a great challenge for new leadership. The environmental lobby, on the other hand, just wants to stop everything. That does not supply the resources that it takes. That's no answer to anything, and so in that sense, it's bankrupt. Here is, Jason, here's the family issue that you mentioned really, really struck a chord with me, because it's like we've gotten to where we look away from the future of some families. I met a guy from North Dakota, from Williston, North Dakota, actually. His first name was Steve, a really young guy. And he told this story. This was at a public BLM hearing, where he essentially stood up and said, you know, I grew up in this town and I loved it here. I loved growing up here. And I just assumed, like all of my other classmates, that I was going to have to leave. I would love for my kids to be able to grow up the same way I did, with the same small town values and learn the same things that I learned. But I assumed I was going to have to go somewhere else because this town was dead. But then along came the Bakken play and the oil boom, and all of a sudden, I not only have a good job, I have a good job, and my kids are going to grow up, in the same city. He was talking all about his kids and his future and his family. He wanted his grandkids to experience what he did. And so for him, the future of his family was directly tied, absolutely directly tied to the future of the energy industry. And there's a tie there that a lot of people forget. We think the energy industry is just ExxonMobil. But it's people like Steve everywhere, all over the country.
You know, a lot of the stuff that we talk about on our program is the energy ecosystem. It takes a big team to keep this energy economy going. In fact, some of the stuff we're doing right here is a big part of that. And, of course, the cafes and the truckers. And, you know, it's not just midstream and downstream. It's also the salmon stream, you know. It's the people outside of the area, you know. And in Williston, you know, you got to talk about also emergency services and all these other things that really keep the energy economy going. I joke because my son, I'm a small business owner. My son, he's got a business too. It's called Kids and Capitalism. And it's just a way for him to make some money on the side. He's got a little podcast he does. He interviews these business owners and inventors and politicians and a number of different things. And every now and then he'll fill in for me if we'll kind of do a promotional thing. And we ran an ad for a while to reinforce the Bakken's longevity back when people were talking about the bust days. We took out ads on our program that aired on 30-plus radio stations saying that I'm just keeping my son's company going right now because this is actually my 9-year-old son's company, because that's how long the Bakken is going to be around. And a lot of these shale plays, it's a 4 or 5 generation play. So we would talk about that, about how it's actually what I'm doing right now is I'm just keeping this warm for the next generation. Do you find that, still with oil and gas, that when a guy starts a midstream company, he's actually really looking at handing it off to his kid because he understands how secure and how honest oil and gas is?
Or can be, unless we let, once again, unless we let the regulatory state get in the way and shut it down prematurely. The guy again that I've mentioned, that guy Steve at the public hearing, he didn't stand up and say, "I hate what's happening to Williston because they brought in a bunch of trailer houses." That was the guy from Berkeley who said that. He didn't say, "Oh, there's never going to be enough water." The guy from Berkeley said that, but Steve's view of it was, "I know there are challenges that go with this, so let's work together to fix them because this matters. This is given opportunity to people who wouldn't have had it otherwise." So it's not that there are no challenges with it at all, but if we address them, you know, together and in a responsible and reasonable and honest way, then we'll figure it out and we'll fix them, and everybody will have a more prosperous life. And it can go on, as you say, for a really long time. There's lots of energy on this earth.
Well, Greg, one of your favorite parts of your story, and I have many, but the fact that you're a fifth-generation Coloradan. Next week we are going to have a discussion with a woman from Pennsylvania who lives on a farm. Smart lady, teacher. She's been living on that farm for six generations. And she now has people telling her what she should do with her property and what is environmentally friendly and what isn't. So we're going to have a chance to talk to somebody who is right in the middle of that scrum between the regulators, the people who are trying to ban fracking in Pennsylvania, and those people who are living in it and who feel they are much better qualified to make those kind of decisions because she loves the land.
Hmm. Yeah, as they are better qualified. So I look forward to listening to that. You guys do a great job of providing the points of view that very often get left out of these stories.
I think what's going to be interesting, I might just bring this up just to, you know, be a little bit of a guy that just, you know, points you in the chest saying, "Am I bothering you yet? Am I bothering you yet?" I don't know if you're familiar with, I think it's New London versus Kelo, which is a, I think it's Kelo. I get okay, it is Kelo. Okay, great. It's the one with economic development where you can go in and do eminent domain for economic development. It's been done for, you know, mini malls and that sort of thing. I'm curious to see if a landowner could use that for an oil and gas well on their property versus an environmental, let's stop it down. Let's see that immovable force hit the immovable object in court.
That opens a whole can of worms on the eminent domain question. Yeah. We understand the need for governments to be able to do that, to build roads and infrastructure like that. But in a case like Kelo, where the government takes away private property just for the sole purpose of giving it to a different property owner because they don't like this owner, they want that owner, they would rather have a Walmart than a local hardware store or whatever it may happen to be. That is an abuse, obviously, of the eminent domain power. And so every time it gets struck down by some court, I always do a little cheer.
Can you believe that, by the way? I mean, I did a story on that, and I did a story on water in North Dakota. If you have a chance, Google the Western Area Water Supply. I did a five-part series on it, and that's what they did, essentially, was a lot of that type of thing in order to build a infrastructure. The short version is that they thought the Bakken boom was going to go for a long time. The state allocated a lot of money to a lot of different things. An engineering firm created a water project that they said would cost $150 million. They're now at $465 million with no end in sight. And the engineering firm has made over $70 million, and no one is questioning it. No one is. So we did kind of a little bit of a research thing on it, and that Kelo versus New England came in. And honestly, I couldn't believe. I had to double-check that. I had to call the Attorney General of North Dakota and say, "Is this right? Am I reading this right?" Because I can't believe that they can take my property and give it to Walmart just because a bunch of local people think Walmart has better economic development than what I'm proposing. Greg, is that's pretty much a very, very basic version of that lawsuit, isn't it?
It is, and so it's always just a question of who gets to decide what's better and what isn't. What if government were to come in and say, whatever oil and gas development has meant in that region, we don't like it anymore. We don't want that. So we're going to condemn all of the mineral rights and all the oil and gas property, take it away, because we'd rather have a widget factory in Bismarck. So we're going to take away all of the water that's being used by all the other uses in the state and give it to that particular property so that they can build a widget factory. Anybody obviously would say that is an abuse of government's power. But on a sort of smaller scale and here and there incrementally, it happens all over America all the time.
Yeah, without a doubt. Now, we got to wrap up here. I'm looking at the clock, and we should probably get into some final thoughts and, you know, just kind of good talks today and kind of bring it back to the water talk a little bit. And unfortunately, that's where it ends up usually going, is eminent domain, and to actually understand that there is legal political devices out there for people to use to manipulate in order to get things either through a private activist group or whatever the case might be, is a little scary. So people should pay attention to things like this. Because they are happening. They're happening all the time. And people are busy in today's world, and it's difficult to trust a lot of different things. So hopefully, you know, we bring you enough experts and enough context in order to decide for yourself on certain issues. But we seem to think that the future is bright for energy, but at the end of the day, water is one of those issues that really should be paid attention to because of the scarcity and the outright just potential for lawsuits. Is that kind of what we're talking about here, Greg? At the end of the day, I guess the scarcity demands our attention.
Ironically, it's always what we're talking about in the West. No matter what issue you're talking about, eventually you're going to get to water because it is the great underlying resource that upon which all others depend. So all issues eventually get around to water. And just the fact that there is hardly any of it present in the West just really highlights and underscores the need for us to be very careful in the way we use it and always conservation-minded, thinking about how we're going to store that water during the periods when the snow is running off, so that we'll have it for the rest of the year, because it doesn't snow in August. And so all of the issues in the West eventually will get us back to that.
I would add one thing. As of yesterday, there is an eminent domain case for pipelines. It's called the Mountain Valley Pipeline, and there are 20 or so landowners who are trying to prevent this pipeline, even though it's been approved and all. So there's always this this band of sensible ideas, and of course everything, including eminent domain, can be abused. But on the other hand, so can the ability of one or two, and in this case a small amount of people who have been obstructionist, and now a federal judge had to call them into court and say, we're going to give you a very fair price for this, the same price everybody else who's already agreed to it, but you are not going to be able to stop this pipeline. So you know where I stand. I'm much more of an individualist. But on the other hand, there is that other argument that there are sometimes when things like eminent domain make some kind of eminent sense.
All right, Greg Walsher, right? Greg Walsher?
Yes, thanks.
All right. That Natural Resources Group, Stephen Hines, the professor, and myself, Jason Spies. You know, I wrote down democracy, and my internet's been down, so I can't look at this, but I thought I remember reading at some point that democracy really meant, I think in Latin, like mob rules. And I remembered that because that's kind of the ugly side of democracy. When we get into an extremism time, it does seem like a mob rules, to where there's no logic. It's just it's what the mob wants, the mob gets. And that's where I really hope that we can pull ourselves out of that and start having a little bit more individual thought. And I like that local thought, because the local thought really kind of breaks up that mob thinking, that blanket templated thinking that the federal government tries to put in there a little bit. But anyway, I just thought I wrote that down, democracy, mob rules, when we were talking about the extremism things. And I couldn't look it up online.
That's the reason that we have a republic and not a pure democracy, because pure democracy means three wolves and one sheep voting on what's for dinner.
Given the last election, has the Electoral College ever made more sense than it did in the last election? And that goes back to what you were saying, Greg, about big cities determining what the rest of the country does. When I start having a discussion these days about the Electoral College, I think it is very evident that we still need all 50 states to decide with equal power who will regulate us, who will be in charge of the country, and it's worth preserving, and it looks pretty smart from 240 years away.
All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your time today, and we'll be talking down the road.
You bet. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. It's been great fun.
Thank you.